You are not going where we are going. Yes, Karim laughed. Have a nice trip. And he turned and walked away, the sun on his back, dust on the soles of his Nike shoes. Soon he would be an unbeliever, and after his death, he would walk the bridge over hell as all souls do. And Bassam could only leave it to the most merciful to spare him from the fall to Jahannam. For Karim and the rest did not know who they were talking to. Shuhada, martyrs who would sit in the highest rooms with Allah, men whose names would never be forgotten.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. Author André Debus III has received some criticism for his portrayal of one of the 9/11 hijackers in his new novel, The Garden of Last Days. But Debus's story succeeds when he examines other characters moving unsuspectingly in the same South Florida circles in the days before 9/11. One is a hapless stripper named April. Another is a misguided regular who kidnaps her toddler daughter in a desperate attempt at self-redemption. André Debus is best known for his 1999 novel, The House of Sand and Fog, which was made into an Oscar-winning movie and uses similarly interlocking narration for the major characters. This reading of The Garden of Last Days took place in June 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
I'm going to read just briefly. I mean, my favorite part of getting up in front of people in this context is not to read from my book, because you can go read that yourself if you're inclined. It's really to have a conversation. I know that also there are always a lot of writers and, well, readers in the room, and so there's a lot to talk about. So I'm just going to read 6 or 7 pages from two points of view. The first one's self-explanatory. The second one is the 26-year-old young Saudi Arabian Bassam. In this scene, I'll tell you when I get there. I'm just going to start reading. Late summer, 01, Thursday. April drove north on Washington Boulevard in the late afternoon heat. She passed housing developments behind acacia and cedar trees, Spanish moss hanging from their limbs like strings of dead spiders. Between her legs was the black coffee she'd bought at the mobile station on the way out of town, and it was too hot to drink. The sun still shining bright over the gulf and blinding her from the side, like something she should have seen coming. Like Jean getting laid up, and now there's no one to watch Franny, and no calling in sick at the Puma. And little Franny was strapped in her car seat in the back, tired and happy with no idea how different tonight will be, how strange it could be. But even in September, Thursday was a big money night, 700 to 800 take home. And that's what April concentrated on as she drove, Franny's chin starting to loll against her chest. April made herself think of that fat roll of 10s and 20s she'd have at closing, how she'd fold it into the front pocket of her jeans, then go to the house mom's office off the dressing room and give Tina 100 before she found Franny in her PJs on Tina's brown vinyl couch. And she'd try not to think of the walls above Tina's desk covered with dancers' schedules and audition Polaroids of naked women, some of them under postcards from girls who came and went. In the corner were a small TV and VCR, where once Lewis kept playing a porno starring Bobby Blue, who used to dance at the Puma as Denise, though the name her mother gave her was Megan. But Tina would be sure no tapes like that were around. She'd let Franny watch Disney videos as long as she wanted, bring her chicken fingers and fries from the kitchen, play cards with her, or give her the back of an old schedule she could draw on with a Puma pen. And if the noise from the club got too loud, the rock and roll numbers the DJ blasted, the constant clink of bottles and glasses from the bar, all the men's hooting and hollering, Tina would turn up Aladdin or Cinderella or The Little Mermaid and pull the sliding door halfway shut so she could keep the right girls on rotation at the right time. Because it was all just a show, April told herself now. It was just a different kind of show business, and Franny'd have to be backstage just this one time, and she'd be fine. She was only 3, and she wouldn't know what she was seeing, and she'd be fine. April passed the industrial park, acres of one-story buildings behind hurricane fences, barbed wire coiled along the top, the sky in endless coral haze. She checked Franny in the rearview mirror. There was a ring of grape around her mouth from the slush puppy she let her have at the mobile. April had put sunblock all over her in Jean's garden. Jean, with her heavy body and aging face, she always looked embarrassed to take April's rent and had never taken a penny all these months to babysit Franny. But nothing's for free, and you should never count on anything that is. And April wanted to know how she could have fallen so easily into thinking that Jean and her kindness was a sure thing she could trust. How could she not have found at least one backup babysitter in all the months she'd been here, just in case? And Jean sounding so guilty on the phone from the hospital, 2 days of tests, a bunch of tests for her heart. Up ahead on the southbound side of the boulevard was a neon sign for the Puma Club. 30 feet high and always on, it was two silhouettes of naked women, one standing, the other sitting with a knee drawn up to her breast. Just seeing it, something hot and hard gathered in April's stomach. Because even when she'd auditioned for Lewis back in March, when she'd done her routine to a ZZ Top song out on the floor of the empty club at 8 a.m, she hadn't brought Franny inside with her. Instead, she'd parked the Sable under the trees, and she'd locked her into the car with coloring books and crayons, a chocolate milk, and 2 powdered donuts. She checked the doors twice and told Franny through the glass to lie down on her belly and eat and draw, and as she walked toward the club, she tried to ignore the muffled cry of her daughter calling her from the car. April told herself it was in the shade and it was hard to see unless you were looking for it, that it was all locked up anyway, and what else could she do? Leave her alone back in the motel? They'd been here only 3 weeks and knew no one. She'd be done in less than 30 minutes anyway, though it turned out to be 45. And when she'd run to the car and unlocked it, it was full of heated air and Franny was sweating and it looked like she'd cried a while. April had wiped her face and made her drink the rest of her chocolate milk, though it was warm, and she swore she'd never do anything even close to that ever again, and took them to a lunch and matinee they couldn't afford. April slowed for the legal U-turn through the median strip. A patch of gravel she steered onto too fast, rocking her Sable, splashing hot coffee through her jeans onto her thigh. Shit! She turned and checked Franny. Her chin had swung to her other shoulder, but she was still asleep. April edged up to the southbound boulevard and waited for a Winnebago to lumber by. Her thigh burned. She reached for the box of tissues and pressed one on the spill. Barely cool air blew in her face, and at this moment she hated this car and her ex-husband for buying it. She hated Jean and her weak heart. She hated Tina, the house mom, for being the one to watch over her Franny. She even hated Florida and its Gulf Coast that Stephanie up north had told her she'd love. But more than anything, she hated herself, April Marie Connors, for doing what she was about to do, for breaking the one rule she swore she'd never break, pulling out onto the macadam, then driving into the crushed shell lot of the Puma Club for Men, her daughter Franny right there in the car with her. That's how our cheerful little tale begins. I don't think I'm giving much away. Pretty soon in the novel, Franny goes missing, can't find her. And in this scene, deeper in the novel, there are police questioning male customers and not letting them leave. One of them is this young 26-year-old Saudi Arabian who has come back to the Puma Club after having been there before, and he's come back to see April. I'll just read you a brief section of his. These kuffar, look at them. They sit at the dirty tables in this dirty hole wearing the short pants that show themselves. They smoke and laugh, and some of them seem frightened of their own police as they are asked one at a time into the front area to be questioned. Soon Bassam will be as well. Twice he has checked his pockets, and 3 times he has inspected his license to make certain it is the one from Florida, not Virginia, though his part will be activated in Massachusetts, a word he cannot say. Only Boston. This he can say. Most of these policemen are young, like him. They believe they are strong, but it would be easy to kill them. He has learned so many ways to do it. Hand to hand, knife to gun, gun to bomb. At the camp for training, he was best with small weapons, and there is the feeling he has been given a gift he will never use. Beside his table, 2 men laugh. On their fingers are the rings of wives. One of them wears a tie and shirt, his sleeves folded back to reveal a gold watch, and he smiles briefly at Bassam, who does not return it. but he nods so as not to incite an argument, so as not to draw attention. A young policeman curls his finger to the businessman who jokes with the other and rises. Bassa must be permitted to leave soon. There is the drive back to the east. He should be there before sunrise for the first prayer. Amir is in the north now, but each dawn for days the Egyptian has kicked his mattress and Tariq's mattress and the mattress of Imad. The time of living like the Kufar is over. Get up and perform your ablutions, my brothers. We must pray for strength. Prayer is better than sleep. Rise. The Jew owner moves among the tables, grasping his pot of coffee. He sees to the comfort of these people. He wishes to come back again and again. One of the whores, the white one with the red hair, follows with cream and sugar, and Bassam allows the Jew to pour his coffee, though he will no longer touch the cup touched by the Jew. This hatred gives him strength. The hatred that was so pure and clear in the disciplined months in camp, the hatred that began to weaken in Dubai and has weakened further here in this Florida with its heat and all the women who each day show so much of themselves. Amir has moved them to many places. Delray Beach, Boynton Beach, Hollywood, Deerfield, the small rooms smelling of men and incense and the pizza they often eat, the empty boxes stacked upon the floor near the kitchen sink where they would perform their ablutions. But moving so much has kept them united, Bassam and Imad and Tariq like one man now, a shaheed with three heads, but one heart, one heart. With Amir, they had enrolled at gymnasiums in each town, places where the Kufar go to keep their bodies as well maintained as the Grand Am and Le Mans and Duster Bassam and his brothers had driven in their old nothingness. At the first one in Venice, because they knew nothing of lifting weights, the gym manager assigned them a trainer Amir ignored. He did not change into exercise clothing as the others did, but remained dressed in a collared shirt and pressed pants and leather shoes from Germany. He moved from machine to machine, pushing or pulling on whatever handles or bars there were to hold, sweating lightly, not speaking to or even looking at the woman trainer named Kelly who tried to correct him. She was young, the age of Bassam, Tariq, and Imad. Tariq, that habit of never closing his lips fully, which makes him look stupid, though he is not, he stared at her body you could see so easily in its tight gym clothing, her uncovered arms and legs, centimeters of her flat belly, too. And Imad, tall, heavy Imad, who back home had told jokes and laughed, which made everyone else laugh. Since the camps, he has grown quiet. His laughter turned to stone, and he listened to the young trainer talk as if deciding the most efficient way to kill her. But Bassam liked her brown eyes, her brown hair, how she had it tucked up into pins revealing her neck, how she smiled at him and touched his shoulder or arms or back as she instructed him. She was kind. He could see it and feel it. She was kind. As were so many others. Gloria, the real estate woman who found them their first apartment in Delray Beach. She was short and wore very much jewelry and lipstick, but she laughed at whatever she said and looked into Bassam's eyes with hers, blue and smiling, and he felt liked by her even though she did not know him. It made him want to sit with her, a kafir and a woman, and sip tea and tell her things he had never told to anyone. She asked them their names and tried to pronounce them correctly, though she could not, and she laughed at herself, squeezed his arm, and he could not bear being in her presence any longer. There was Cliff, the man at the fuel station store 3 blocks south. Taller than Bassam, he was as old as his father, his hair colored blonde, his whiskers gray. Upon his arms were inked figures of naked women, and when Bassam came in for more bread or cokes, he asked how his studies were coming. Was he having any goddamn fun? There were the women who served them food in restaurants, the young ones or older ones, the pretty or the ugly. They were polite and smiled while looking them in their eyes, except Amir's. Their smiles changed then. They could see and feel his hatred for them. And Bassam had felt soft and weak and not worthy of the title Shaheed. These people should fear him too. He was prepared to do what he was chosen for. They must not doubt this. No one should question this. It had been months since their training, and now he and Tariq and Imad were back home. After the purity of camp, where daily they had fought hand to hand, where they fired the AK-47 while running, where they wired plastic explosives while reciting from Al-Anfal and Al-Tawbah, where they fasted and cleansed themselves, and where their softness fell away like fat from a lamb. It was difficult being once again in the dusty and idle streets of Khamis Mashat. Karim and the others wanted to race, to smoke, to gossip, to stay baboons. Imad and Tariq had grown beards and tried to teach their old friends to stay away from these evils. But Karim, standing before them in his Nike cap and T-shirt and jeans, his shiny cell phone in his hand, he was already lost. For 2 years, he had studied in London, something he was always boasting, and he showed them the photograph of the Zionist girl from Jerusalem who had loved him, his mind soiled, his heart falling to the West. Karim told them they should not believe everything the imams say. Read the Quran, my friends. It says, Al-Kitab, the people of the book, Christians and Jews, deserve respect because they are fellow monotheists. Have you read all the surahs? Because I have. Read 3:113-115. They believe in Allah and the last day. They enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong, and they hasten in the emulation of all good works. They are in the ranks of the righteous. And that is why they enslave the Palestinians, Tariq said. That is why they occupy our land and kill our brothers in Iraq. You have fucked a Jew. What can you tell us about anything? Go play with your cell phone. You are not going where we are going. Yes, Karim laughed. Have a nice trip. And he turned and walked away, the sun on his back, dust on the soles of his Nike shoes. Soon he would be an unbeliever, and after his death, he would walk the bridge over hell as all souls do. And Bassam could only leave it to the most merciful to spare him from the fall to Jahannam. For Karim and the rest did not know who they were talking to. Shuhada, martyrs who would sit in the highest rooms with Allah, men whose names would never be forgotten. Thank you very much. So how are you? I'm from Boston. I thought I'd just chat just a minute or two about how I came to write this novel, and then I was hoping we could just have a conversation. I said I'll try a short story, actually. I wasn't trying to write a novel. I just had an image in my head, and the image was a wad of cash on a bureau. And that's all it was, just a wad of cash, and I didn't know what it was. And over the years, I've really learned to trust the imagination, and not just my imagination, but the imagination, you know, the one we are all born with. And so I wrote myself into this image, and the deeper I got into it, it was clear that they were tips. And then it was clear that they weren't waitress or bartender tips, but a stripper's tips. And then I knew where the image came from. It came from those strange articles a lot of us read after those attacks of some of these men having been seen in strip clubs days before they did what they did. And I couldn't get my mind around that. I mean, how could they be so extremist in their religion, and on one hand, to do what they did, yet also go to strip clubs? Some actually even hired a call girl in Boston. One was seen in a porn shop in New Jersey. So it was a fascinating mix there. But I was actually more interested in the woman. What would it be like to have been a woman who danced naked for one of these men, and then after the smoke is cleared and the terrible deed has been done, what would it be like to have his blood money in your bank or on your dresser? And I was just going to write a short story from the point of view of a woman, maybe follow her for 48 hours and, you know, 20 pages. But one thing led to another, to another, to another, and it's clear it's going to be a novel. The irony is, I know that now this book will be called a 9/11 book, and it's already being reviewed as a 9/11 book. And here's the weird thing. I never thought about 9/11 when I was writing it, if that makes any sense at all. Because I was trying just so hard to be completely deeply in the lives of these people days before, I really didn't think about September 11th. So about the second or third year into writing this, I could feel this deep intuitive pull from this character of Bassam that he wanted the microphone. He wanted for me to go into his point of view. And I resisted it, and I think I resisted it for two reasons. One was a small resistance, and the second one was a larger resistance. The first resistance was in my novel before that, House of Sand and Fog, I had a Middle Eastern character. And I didn't want to repeat myself and have another Middle Eastern character, but that's so stupid of me. I mean, in House of Sand and Fog, this is a Shiite a secular, by the way, non-practicing Shiite Muslim Iranian middle-aged military man. And in this one, it's a young extremist Sunni Muslim Saudi. I mean, it's like saying, well, I wrote about a Hungarian. I can't have a Mexican in this book. They're different people. Right? So, but then that wasn't the real one. I realized what the real resistance was. You know, Hemingway has a great line that I try to live by creatively. He said, you know, the job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. And I realized that my primary resistance was I wasn't sure I could withhold my judgment of this guy in order to do what the novelist has to do, which is become these people, to actually put myself so deeply in his shoes, I am him. You know, we all have stories of that day. I didn't lose anyone like thousands of others did. Ironically, September 11th is my birthday, and I got a birthday call, and I was going upstairs, and, you know, the TV came on, all that stuff. But I teach at UMass Lowell, and 3 days a week, I drive through this little town on the way to the highway, and because we're north of Boston, quite a few people in those towns were killed on those planes. And I passed the house of a woman who lost her 38-year-old husband that morning. She was pregnant with their second child. He was a surfer. He made a living as a salesman. Matter of fact, didn't even like his job. And matter of fact, that morning, he didn't even want to go. This was a newspaper article I've never been able to forget. And he was never in the habit of waking up his kid. He had a two-year-old. And he, even though it was 4:30 in the morning, he went into the bedroom and kissed him, which he'd never done before. So now he's gone. And I pass his widow's house. And many mornings, I see her in the yard with the child he never got to meet. And I say a prayer of forgiveness to her dead husband. And then I say a prayer to her. And one day maybe I'll work up the courage to meet her. And why do I say a prayer of forgiveness? Because I'm spending my days trying to be one of the men who actually killed this real man and 3,000 others. So Bassam, though, is one of seven characters. When I finished this book, it was 800 pages long, and there were 12 characters. And that's what editors are for, the sadists. But there you have it. All sorts of stuff going on in this story, and I hope you go and get it. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
So you said that as a novelist, you have to become each one of these characters. Could you compare the experience of a novelist to that of an actor?
Yeah, I think they're sister art forms. You know, I'm a big fan of acting. And have you ever acted?
Yeah.
I figured. Because it's an actor's question. Right? So the kind of acting that I love is real acting, where they're not pretending to have an emotion, or as directors say, don't indicate, you know, which means don't pretend to be surprised, be surprised. So one reason acting can be so emotionally draining is because the actor really takes on these emotions and then expresses them, right? So, yeah, exactly. At least, not every writer would agree, but at least I certainly try to. There's a wonderful essay by Flannery O'Connor called The Nature and Aim of Fiction. I think it's one of the only essays you really need to read about writing. Well, there are a lot of good stuff out there, but that's a great one. One of the things she says in this essay is that the writer's job is not to write about character, but with character. So you're not hovering above them like some god. You've got to become them. You've got to become them. You know, Lao Tzu has this great line, soften the light, become one with the dusty world. Isn't that beautiful? So, yeah. So, ultimately, for me, but this, I'm talking about character-driven fiction, the kind that I try to write, because it's not all character-driven fiction out there. For me, it's a sustained act of empathy, this constant question of what's it like to be you? What's it like to be you? And, you know, sometimes, you know, you can fall flat on your face and get it completely wrong. But I'll tell you what, too, I have to say, I really believe that we all have this ability, not just writers or actors or my wife's a choreographer, or other kinds of artists. I think deep down in the imagination, and again, we all get equally powerful and strange ones when we're born, deep down there, I really think is the knowledge of the other. I really do. I've been feeling it even more than ever the last few years of my writing existence. Thank you. Well, you guys have to get up and be part of the show now.
You sound completely American to me, and I'm wondering how you managed to get not only into the mind but into the heart of the main character in The House of Sand and Fog. I work in an international organization with a lot of Iranians, and he seemed more Iranian than anyone that I had ever met. And I'm just wondering how you accomplished that.
God bless you. What's your name?
Krista.
Hi, Krista.
Hi.
I bring her to all my readings. Say that stuff about the Iranian thing. Yeah. Well, that's a high compliment, and thank you. Well, I'm going to go back to what I said. I really think that if everybody else sat down 2 to 3 hours a day, 5, 6 days a week for months and years to try to imagine someone else's experience, you go pretty damn far in getting there too. For me, the Iranian connection was I fell in love with an Iranian girl when I was in college. I was 16, 17. She was gorgeous. I couldn't even breathe around her. And she sure as hell didn't notice little Milltown me. She's from an upper-class Iranian family. And then I discovered you can't date an Iranian girl the way I dated, which was, hey, I stole a six-pack. Want to go in the weeds and drink it? That was my date. I couldn't even see her outside of class. The only way I could see her was to go to her apartment of her family and sit with them. And that's as close as I got. You know, we'd sit at the sofre and eat Persian food, and there'd be the brother, the sister, the mother, and there she was way over there. And then the father came, and then he was here, then the brother. I got more kisses from the father than I ever got from her. And it was the first time I got kissed by a man. He said, well, women have to put up a stubble. What a pain that is. But I became conversational in Farsi. I wasn't fluent, but I could, all this stuff in there. Every now and then they'd say, Andre, my name, and I'd look. What are they saying? Are they smiling or grimacing? And so that helped. That helped. But you know, Alice Munro, the great short story writer, said about factual detail that it's like starter dough that you use to bake the bread, to make the loaf that bakes the bread. And so it's very helpful to get this real stuff that's there. But then again, it's the same process, whether you're writing from the point of view of an Iranian and you're a white guy from north of Boston, or if you're writing from the point of view of a woman or a child when you're growing. I mean, again, it's this question, which I think is better fuel for writing than answers. I find whenever I've gone into the writing of fiction with answers and a point I wanted to make, I killed it. Killed it.
When you were describing the office of the woman at the strip club, who was the organizer, the manager, the person. The house mom. It just sounded extremely specific, the way her office looked, the things inside it. So I got to ask you, did you do research in strip clubs?
I actually did. This was such a weird marital moment for me. So I got this really cool fellowship, the Guggenheim Fellowship, which is designed to give... Yeah, it's a pretty hoity-toity fellowship. He already knows where I'm going with this. It's designed to give writers time and money to travel, do research for their books, whatever. So I'm setting out to write my short story about one of these women. And honestly, I'd been to one strip club when I was 20. I was drunk at a bachelor party. I found it depressing and expensive. It wasn't boring, but it was depressing and expensive. And it was the Golden Banana, Saugus, Mass. Right? Frank? I bring my posse wherever I go, you understand? So, I'm lost now. So, I go to my wife, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, here I am. I've got money, I've got time. I'm going to fly to Florida, go to the very clubs these guys were seen in. And it wasn't just about the strip world. It was also, I really want to kind of smell Florida, walk through Florida, look at the vegetation, and really just kind of soak it up. And so I went to my wife, said, honey, I think I need to do a little research this weekend. I think I actually need to go to Florida. She said, really? For what? Well, you know, and I think I should bring my best friend from high school and my brother, Jeb. Why? Well, they're big guys. And I don't know where I'll be going, but we basically need to go strip clubs all weekend, honey. She looked at me. She says, you know, you could really screw me over. Can I go? Yeah, you can go. And I did. And I went and I spent 3 days in strip clubs and blew a lot of money. I mean, instead of getting a private dance for $20 every 6 minutes, I was asking them questions. And there went that Guggenheim money. But I learned a lot. And I put it all in here for you. Thank you for that question. Any other thoughts, disagreements, lawsuits, outright disagreements?
You say it's a non-9/11 novel, and you seem to be focused on the soldier character and the woman. So do you make any leaps about how we get to here, how we get to today, and the disasters of post-9/11? How do you handle all of that stuff that we're all thinking about? Maybe you don't.
Well, let me just say, I think writers are the last people to, who have a right even to say what their book is about. It's an honor and a privilege to have your work published and distributed for people to read. And I really believe that it's up to the reader to describe the book. So when I say it's not a 9/11 novel, what do I know? On one level, you're going to read, if you read this, you'll say, what's he talking about? Of course, it deals directly with 9/11. In some respects, it goes into the heart of that experience. I guess what all I'm trying to say is I never was planning on writing about it. In fact, I didn't even want to write about it. There's a great ancient Chinese line that I'm fond of, and the line is, if the mad dog comes at you, whistle for him. So it's a, you know, it's about fear and embracing fear. And I'll tell you what, the book does go 7 years ahead for a little bit. But my most honest answer is, when you ask, does it deal with the post of 9/11, blah, 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 I am not sure. Because I had a really interesting conversation with this woman in Los Angeles recently. She said, so you don't outline your stories? I said, no. You never plan what you're going to say? No, because this occurred to me just a month ago. When I'm writing nonfiction, I feel I'm gripped by a story to tell because, you know, I'm writing about when Uncle Harry threw up on the Thanksgiving turkey and I have a story to tell. I want to inflict it upon you and tell you. But when I'm writing fiction, I don't have a story to tell. I have a story to find, right? So she says, so you don't think when you're writing? She said, no. I try to dream when I'm writing. I try just to dream it through, dream it through, dream it through. She said, oh, so then readers of these books are really just dream interpreters. Isn't that good? I said, yes. So I leave it to you, Leonard, to interpret that dream. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.